From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. After 12 seasons, NYPD Blue is ending its run. On today's Fresh Air, the show's co-creator, David Milch, tells us why the show almost didn't make it to air. Then we'll meet the man who played Lieutenant Arthur Fancy, actor James McDaniel. And we'll talk with actor Dennis Franz. He worked on both NYPD Blue and its predecessor, Hill Street Blues. Finally, Detective Bill Clark, who served on the real New York City police force for 25 years, explains how he became a creative consultant on that show. This year's Academy Awards host, Chris Rock, says he welcomes the multi-second delay in case something less than censor-friendly comes out of his mouth. Coming up, he'll tell us about growing up in one of New York's toughest neighborhoods. And we review the new film, Diary of a Mad Black Woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Baldwin?
Yeah.
I think I'm going to put in my papers.
Are you serious?
I think it's time.
That's one of many heartfelt goodbyes we've heard on NYPD Blue as the 12-year-old ABC police drama comes to an end. Next Tuesday, ABC presents the finale of the show that pushed the envelope for broadcast TV dramas. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from some of the talent in front of and behind the cameras at NYPD Blue. We'll visit with Dennis Franz, who, as Andy Sipowicz, was the only cast member to star in the entire run of the show. James McDaniel, who played Andy's first boss, and real-life detective Bill Clark, a creative consultant and executive producer on the series. And we'll begin today's show by talking with the co-creator of NYPD Blue, David Milch. Milch and his collaborator Stephen Bochco, who already had shaken up the cop show genre with the gritty Hill Street Blues, planned NYPD Blue as a way to make the adult TV drama even more adult, by pushing the acceptable standards on language, violence, even nudity. When it launched, some ABC affiliates refused to air it. But when the show became an instant hit, the complaints stopped, and NYPD Blue began its long, successful, influential run. Terry spoke with David Milch last year, just after the launch of his latest controversial series, the HBO Western Deadwood. She asked him about the early days of NYPD Blue and how it was received when it began.
NYPD Blue almost didn't go on the air. It was delayed for over a year. The network refused to let it go forward. And once the network committed, more than one-third of the ABC affiliates refused to air the program. So I am quite familiar with the imposition of other people's ideas of what it was proper to portray. I had to, you know, that was the subject of long negotiation between Stephen Bochco and the ABC censors about how many obscenities could be used, in what combination, what the, those were negotiations from which I was excluded early on because my participation tended not to be constructive. You know, I kind of respond apocalyptically to that kind of stuff, and so I was disinvited from the conversations.
I want to get back to something that we were talking about before, which is language. You know, and there were restrictions on the language you could use on Hill Street and NYPD Blue. I'm sure you assumed that these characters would be using a lot more profanity and obscenity if they weren't restricted. So how do you get around that? What kind of language could you give them that implies that they be using saltier language if allowed, but this will take the place of it?
Yeah. I always found that stuff a little silly because I can make up words which are much more obscene because words derive their meaning from the context in which they're used. And so I remember the censors wouldn't let... I think in NYPD Blue, the first year or something, Sipowicz was doing an interrogation, and he was confronting a witness with the fact that the witness could not have been where he said he was, or he was a suspect. And he says, "So you're saying on Christmas Eve that you spent Christmas Eve rubbing up and down against Doris Aiello or something like that?" And they said, "No, you can't say rubbing up and down." So I wrote, you say you spent Christmas Eve in close proximity to Doris Aiello's gunya. Now, there is no such word.
Right.
And yet, because of the context, it is a much more vivid image. And that's the point. What's crucial is that they portray the sensibility and, to a large extent, the fears of the character. In the instance of Cops, the inability to use obscenity was not so crucial because the culture of Cops can be portrayed. The obscenity is not of the essence of the Cops character. It's simply a way of releasing a certain amount of tension. Mm-hmm. Now, racial epithets are a different thing. For me, the ability to use racial epithets was crucial in NYPD Blue because so much of the cop's experience has to do with racism, either the racism that afflicts him or the racism of that's institutional. And so I felt deeply a need to be able to use racial epithets where I felt no need it whatsoever to use obscenity because it was not of the essence of the character's experience.
And what were you up against in terms of using racial epithets?
They said, don't use them. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, we're going to use them. and as the ratings went up and the affiliates, you know, we get back to the old subject of commerce. One-third of the ABC affiliates refused to run the show. Well, after the show was on the air for a couple of weeks, and it was clear that it was getting good ratings and that people had come to experience beyond whatever titillation they thought they were going to find, something that they wanted to come back to on a weekly basis having to do with the rendering of a particular world, then the affiliates began to pick it up, and as the network started to make money, they began to take a little bit more dialectical view of what our ambitions were, Stevens and mine, and to see virtue where before they had seen only vice, and finally, with the proper amount of piety and fanfare, you know, they began to allow us to use certain locutions about race that they had forbidden hitherto.
Does this include, I'll go with, the N-word?
Yes, yeah, specifically the N-word, and specifically the fact that Sipowicz, as a racist, would use that word.
Mm-hmm,
and and it was of the essence of that character's woundedness and the distortion of perspective that had come from his early experiences that he be able to use that word, and that the character who was his partner could then have the opportunity to say, I can't work with you.
So where did
if you're going to speak that way.
Where did the objections come from once you started using the word?
From the bosses at the network.
What about from viewers? Did you get any objections from that?
I don't read that stuff.
Right, because you don't want to be affected by it.
Yeah, I mean, the network will say, well, you can't can't put it on the air.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally found a way around that as time went on. We just didn't let them have the scripts until after the show was shot.
Was that effective?
Well, yeah, it's effective if you're making them money.
I got to know, how do you make up a word like gunya?
You know, it's I don't know. That's my racket.
I mean, what are some of the things you think about when you have to make up like a phony expletive or body part or, you know?
Thinking is invariably the enemy of action. And I don't think, I don't outline my shows. I just sort of try and let it happen.
Right.
And
okay.
So I improvise that stuff on the spur of the moment.
David Milch, co-creator of NYPD Blue, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His new series, Deadwood, begins its second season a week from Sunday. We'll hear from two stars of NYPD Blue, Dennis Franz and James McDaniel, after a break. This is Fresh Air. When NYPD Blue began, Andy Sipowicz was a cop loaded with baggage. He was an alcoholic, a loose cannon, and at least initially, a racist. His first boss, an African-American lieutenant named Arthur Fancy, was inches away from firing Sipowicz. But the two came to understand, teach, and even embrace one another as part of the series' ongoing examination of race and redemption. James McDaniel played Lieutenant Fancy, and played him with as much volatility as Dennis Franz played Sipowicz. As in this scene, in which the two are arguing about Andy's on-the-job use of the N-word.
Would have been smarter for you to go home when the shift ended.
If you're going after me, you bring charges or let Quasi do it. Because I want a chance to answer him in front of somebody besides you.
Yeah, this is about me, Andy. I'm the racist.
I've said that word. I've thought it plenty, but I've never used it on a job till your hump pal put us on that road.
This isn't about a word, Andy, or your impure thoughts. It's about you making this case harder to work.
Not about you being black, huh? Not about giving some back to me?
It's about what I say it's about.
Then say, part of what it's about is watching me sweat.
Well, a hell of a lot went down today, so I'd have to check my notes. But I thought I'd spend some of that time trying to save your sorry ass.
Give me a break.
No, I'm not going to take you out, Andy. I move you out, my white bosses, they send me a little message. They send me another one just like you. But maybe that one can't do the job like you can.
Jeez, thanks a lot, boss.
If you go, it'll be somebody like Quasi, or like that reporter. I've been dealing with white cops like you ever since the academy. I can manage you with my eyes closed. Now, maybe you can't handle a black man being your boss.
I can handle it. I've been covering you 3.5 years, except when you get so tied up in your brother crap, you won't let us work the streets. That's when you get yourself in trouble.
Hey, Lou, we got a report of a person shot near the Houston Street Projects. Want me to handle it?
Was it a homicide?
I don't know.
That teenage girl, the eyewitness, isn't she in those projects?
Yeah, I think we got him out, though.
Sylvie was involved there.
Check it out.
You want me to check it out?
Yeah. Sipwitz will handle it.
Did this scene and the whole episode lead to discussions about race off camera?
Well, I mean, we discuss race a lot anyway, you know, or we kind of used to, you know, especially me and Dennis, you know, because we come from two very different backgrounds. So, you know, we talk about race. It's a part of our dialogue. I mean, we spend a lot of time together.
After having played a cop yourself for several years, what do you think of cops now? Do you find yourself relating to the cops or what?
No, I keep it simple. I relate to people. You know, there's good cops and there's bad cops.
Right.
And, you know, bad cops make bad policy. And vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get just as exasperated by cops now as I ever did. You know, I mean, you know, I drive an expensive car. It's not unusual for me to be pulled over twice on the way home on any given evening, you know, because my windows are slightly tinted. I mean, we know what that's about. So I just take it kind of a person at a time. You know, knowing that it's human nature. There's some good guys and there's some bad guys. I just start talking to him. I start asking him why he's doing this. And I try to get into his psychology so that when we finally separate, he thinks about it a little bit. It was kind of an unusual experience.
What kind of reactions have you gotten after talking with the cops who pull you over?
Well, L.A. cops are tough because they have this veneer that's very unlike New York cops, whereby they try to act like perfect human beings. Hello, sir. How are you? You know, we're just about to shoot you, but have a nice day. You know, they go through some type of training for that. I don't know what it is. You know, it's like smile and hate you at the same time, you know. New York cop, if they don't like you, you know, they make no bones about it. It's like, I don't like you, buddy, right now, right here. Let's go. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, is there anything you've been able to use on NYPD Blue from your experiences, from your encounters with cops who've pulled you over?
Well, you know, if I was a street cop, there definitely would be. My approach would be to play one of those guys because, you know, that goes straight across race lines, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, because I've had that experience. That's why I say it's not necessarily a racial thing, because I've had that experience with black cops, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that hail fellow well met type behavior just as good as anybody else. So, if I was a street cop, I would probably play one of those guys. You know, I don't like just, you know, regular old heroes, you know, just, you know, da-da-da, Dudley-do-right, here he comes. I would play one of those kind of guys. Try to find the humanity in there someplace.
James McDaniel, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Dennis Franz, like McDaniel, was a veteran of previous Stephen Bochco cop shows. He played a bad cop, Sal Benedetto, on Hill Street Blues, then was brought back as a slightly more noble one, Norman Bunce, on the same show. That character was so popular, he was spun off into a sitcom, Beverly Hills Bunce. It was Andy Sipowicz, though, who made Franz a major TV star and who was the heart and soul of NYPD Blue. When the series began, Andy was in major trouble, crying out for help. As it ends, he's the veteran authority figure helping others. In this scene from a recent show, the newly promoted Sergeant Sipowicz stops a skirmish between a cop and a delivery man who's gotten a parking violation. He talks first to the suspect, then to the officer, to defuse the conflict.
All right, what's your story?
I work for the medical lab. I come here every day to pick up the blood samples from the doctor's offices. It takes me 30 seconds. I walk in, I grab the box, and I walk out.
What'd you say to the officer?
I said, I'm trying to make a living.
That's it?
I tried to show the man respect when I first came out. I told him, I got over 30 stops to make. There's no place to park. I don't leave my car but for a minute. But he don't listen. He say, it's too late. That's when I got mad.
All right, step back here a second. Come here. Is that true, what he said?
Pretty much.
What do you want to do here?
What do you mean?
I mean, do you want to create a situation? This is a working man. He's not sticking nobody up. You're going to cost him 2 days' wages with that ticket, and then when he gets mad, you're going to collar him?
What should I have done?
You see him go inside the building, you wait. If he's in there for a while, then you write him up. If he comes right back out again, you talk to him.
What do I say?
Tell him you're trying to keep traffic moving. If he's a right guy, you be a right guy.
And about how long do I wait while he's in the building?
5 minutes.
I'm sorry.
It's the kind of thing you get a feel for after a while.
What do I do now?
Give me a summons. Now go over there, take the cuffs off, tell them they have a nice day.
Yes.
Terry spoke with Dennis Franz in 1987 during the Norman Bunce days and asked him about that character and his own upbringing.
I grew up in a suburb out of Chicago. It was about 7 miles out of the city proper in Maywood. The area was, yes, very much of a working-class neighborhood. My father was a postal worker, and he worked in a factory, and my mother also worked at the post office. There was a heavy, tough element in our neighborhood. We had gangs. I wasn't a part of them, but a lot of my friends were members of gangs, and therefore I had an association with them. I kind of walked a fine line always because I kept those friends, and then when I got involved in theater, of course the gangs didn't want to have nothing to do with the theater, so I had both sides of the fence, and I was able to play both sides too, so I had different groups of friends that were complete opposites.
You know, earlier you were telling us that you knew a lot of gang members, though you never really belonged to the gangs,
yeah,
when you were growing up in a working-class suburb of Chicago. How did you first get interested in acting? What drew you to theater?
A girl I was going out with, it was in my junior year of high school, and she was going to try out for a play called The Crucible. I went along with her. I was involved in three sports up to that time. I was involved in football, baseball, and swim. And this came around the time of the swim season. We were just starting that sport. I went with her to the auditions, and I sat in the room and I watched everybody audition. I didn't even realize up to that point that they had theater at my high school. That's how out of it I was. And I heard everybody auditioning and I heard the guys and I thought, gee, I can do as good as them. So kind of involuntarily, I found myself raising my hand and saying, could I try this? I ended up getting one of the leads and I dropped out of the swim team for that season. I thought, well, if this is my least favorite of the sports anyway, so let me try this. So I tried that play. I thoroughly enjoyed the experience, so that I went out for the next play, and one by one I started eliminating the sports and devoting myself full-time to theater. The girlfriend didn't get cast, by the way, so I lost her as a girlfriend, but I got the career out of the deal.
What kind of parts were you playing back then?
Well, Believe it or not, I was playing leading man type parts. At that time, I looked different and had a little more hair and was a little thinner. And so I was playing a lot of leading men.
You know, something that really troubles me about television and films is that you have to have a lot of hair and be really slim and classically attractive to be a leading man or a leading lady.
That more often than not is the case. I think there have been exceptions to the rule, and I think...
I think you're an exception now, right? I mean, you're...
Well, thank you. Ed Asner, I was referring to, Jack Klugman, even on L.A. Law, just look at Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker, or look around you anywhere, and you'll see matchups of people that don't necessarily always fit.
Dennis Franz, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. Coming up in the second half of the show, more with David Milch, this time with NYPD Detective Bill Clark. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Bantam, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Creating a Legacy of Physical and Emotional Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup, author of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, how the creators of NYPD Blue drew on real-life stories from the files of the New York Police. We'll talk with series consultant, Detective Bill Clark, and the show's co-creator, David Milch. Also, Chris Rock promises, or threatens, to bring some spark to this year's Oscars. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Diary of a Mad Black Woman, starring Tyler Perry. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. We're continuing our salute to NYPD Blue, which leaves the air next week after 12 years on ABC. Here's a scene from the second season of the show. Bobby Simone, played by Jimmy Smits, and Andy Sipowicz, played by Dennis Franz, are questioning a man who had his wallet and his pants stolen. It fit into a case involving men with prostitutes who were held up by pimps. Only this guy insisted he wasn't with a prostitute.
I mentioned to Mr. White this pattern we've been working on where the prostitute gets into the car and points the John to some romantic parking lot off of South Street, and then a hard-working pimp shows up and sticks a gun in his face. How we got two detectives on the street right now trying to put a stop to this before somebody gets shot. But he can't help us with that because this case is unrelated. this is a whole separate phenomenon here because there's no prostitute involved, right, Mr. White?
I told you what happened.
Mr. White told me what happened. So he can't be of help on this pattern that we've been working on where we got these two cops out on the street busting their ass. I'm feeling kind of bad now because I thought Mr. White might be lying.
Well, maybe being in a strange police station, he just can't remember right. Maybe he needs more familiar surroundings.
Could that be Mr. White?
Try taking him over to his house and talking it out with his wife in the room and see if maybe that might jog his memory.
Wait. No, I think we should do that.
All right.
Bill Clark is a retired New York detective who advised and is now an executive producer of NYPD Blue. Clark's famous real-life investigations included the Son of Sam and the Zodiac murders. Terry spoke with Bill Clark in 1995 in a conversation joined by series co-creator David Milch.
On NYPD Blue, when the cops are interrogating a suspect, they try to convince the suspect that the suspect doesn't want to have a lawyer, at least not yet. Why do the cops want to make sure on NYPD Blue that the suspect doesn't have a lawyer until they're done talking?
Yeah, I think people seem to think that the lawyer just comes in to kind of referee the interrogation so that nobody lays a hand on him and he's not intimidated. Well, the reality is if an attorney enters the room, if he allows the suspect to confess, he is then going to be sued for malpractice. So he is not going to allow him to answer any of your questions. So effectively, the interrogation is shut down the minute that he calls for an attorney. So we work very hard to keep him out of there so that we don't shut down what in most cases is the single biggest piece of evidence against the guy, which is a confession.
Now, on the show, the cops are always trying to make it seem like it's going to be a better deal for the suspect if he talks to the cops before the lawyer comes.
Yeah, that's the biggest lie we ever tell. I mean, it's most times...
You suspects out there, Bill doesn't mean it.
Yeah. Most times when a guy sits into that interview room, if he doesn't confess, then a great deal of time he'll wind up either walking back out a free man or it'll be at trial a big piece of evidence against him if he does. I'll give you an example of something. It's not my favorite subject, but the O.J. Simpson case. I think one of the mistakes that was made in that case was there was so much evidence against O.J. Simpson, physical evidence. I've never seen so much circumstantial evidence in any case, that rather than get the confession, they did a brief 30-minute interview with him and let him go. Now, with all of the so-called inconsistencies and mishandling and anything else that was brought out in trial, if there had been a confession from O.J. Simpson, he would have been convicted. There was no way that the jury could have looked past that. And that's the lesson that a detective learns very early in his career is with a confession, it's easier for you on the stand because they're not going to beat you up as hard because they know there's a confession that they've got to deal with. And to me, that's the single biggest thing I've always worked for.
So what are some of the things that a cop might tell a suspect to get the suspect to not make that phone call to the lawyer?
Well, one of the things is you tell a guy, listen, you know, you're the guy that's going to do the time, not the attorney. He's looking to come in here for money. He doesn't care about your welfare. You know, this is the time to make the deal. It's going to help you. You can explain why you did it, the motives behind it. You know, we know you didn't mean this. It was an accident type thing. And, you know, something had to drive you to commit this act. I had a case very similar to the Simpson case a week or two before that. And a man and woman stabbed brutally. The woman was stabbed about 30 times, the man about 60. Trail of blood leaving the scene. I had the guy in about 3 days later. Excuse me. And I told him, I says, listen, you know, this is a vicious crime here. And this is horrible. I says, something had to push you over the edge to do this. You don't want to go in as a crazy man, just a vicious murderer. Something had to do it. And he explained it away that it was a jealousy thing, and he lost control. He had done a few years in jail, and he realized when he cut the first guy that he had blew it and he was going to go back, and he just lost control, and he just stabbed out of frustration.
Bill, would you ever make promises to suspects that you couldn't really keep? In order to help get a confession?
Well, legally, you can't make promises that you can't keep. You can you can lie to him about things, but, you know, as far as time served and stuff like, you know, time that he would do in jail and stuff like that, you can't do. But as far as evidence that I have against him, that I have co-defendants that have flipped and stuff like that, I've lied many, many times.
That you that's legal. You have to understand that. The legal test is you may mislead a suspect so long as the way you mislead him would not make an innocent man confess. In other words, you can't say, I have your wife in the next room, and unless you confess, I'm going to beat her, because then an innocent man might confess. But you are able to say your running mates have confessed. You are able to say, you know, we've got evidence from the scene. We recovered the gun. Because an innocent man would know that that wasn't true.
Bill, you retired from the New York City Police as from your job as a detective during the second season of NYPD Blue. While you were still working as a detective and consulting with the series, was there a new degree of, well, almost self-consciousness that entered your work? Would you be reporting on a case and in the back of your mind see it as an episode?
No, I mean, I did my job as I saw it. I never really thought if a case went down while I was doing it that this would be a good episode. No,
Billy is not someone who is comfortable with that kind of irony or distance when he's working as a detective. He takes that very, very seriously, and I know from speaking with him about cases that he was working on all during the period when he was still an active detective. If you're a good detective, so much of that coincides with being a good storyteller, because what you're trying to do is sort of extrapolate a whole world or a whole personality from pieces of information. And so when Billy would talk about the cases he was working on, he didn't really need to rephrase for my purposes, because just Billy being Billy, and the way I think I say in the book, you know, when Billy would work on cases, you'd watch him get sick over the cases. They would just occupy his whole being, and when a case wasn't going well, he would be miserable and you couldn't talk to him, and so he was like the most beautiful sort of prism for both the case and for a cop reacting to the case.
David Milch and Bill Clark, speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. NYPD Blue ends next week after a 12-year run on ABC. Coming up, this Sunday's Oscar host, Chris Rock. This is Fresh Air. Chris Rock got his start on Saturday Night Live and the sketch comedy series In Living Color. Then he got his own late-night variety show on HBO. He's also starred in several films. On Sunday, Rock will host the Oscars. At first, the Academy and the network expressed concern about whether Rock would be able to curb his profanity. But they ought to be more worried about his willingness to say things that most people, even most comics, avoid. His new comedy album, called Never Scared, illustrates that perfectly. Here's a bit about Michael Jackson, recorded last year in Philadelphia.
What the hell is wrong with Michael? Another kid? Another kid? I thought it was Groundhog's Day when I heard that shit. Another kid? Get the fuck out of here. Yo, that's how much we love Michael. We love Michael so much, we let the first kid slide. Like, come on, man. The man made Billie Jean. Leave him alone. I am done. I love Michael Jackson my whole life. I've been his biggest fan, but I'm done. I'm done. I saw Michael on 60 Minutes. I couldn't take that. Ed Bradley tried his best to make Michael look like a mammal. Just somebody that drank water and breathed air, right? He gave Michael the easiest questions in the world, the easiest GED questions in the world, and Michael could not pass the test. It's like, oh, Michael, do you think it's proper for a 45-year-old man to sleep in a bed with 13-year-old boys? Yes. Okay, let me rephrase that. Michael, would you let your children sleep in the bed of a 45-year-old man that's been accused of child molestation? Yes. Ed Bradley looked at Michael Jackson like he wanted to say, nigga, is you crazy? Like he wanted to take the 60 Minutes clock and push the shit forward. Say, get the fuck off my show. I thought you said it was 60 minutes. It's 10 minutes. Get out of here.
Chris Rock from his new CD, Never Scared. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1997.
Did you go through a radical black consciousness period when you were in your teens?
No, you know, I didn't go through I was in my teens. That's like the 80s. So it's not exactly the most conscious decade or time. You know, I was bused to school as a kid.
Mm-hmm. From where to where?
From Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, to Garrison Beach, Brooklyn, and to Bensonhurst. And, you know, I was getting called nigger since I was, like, in the second grade. So I never, I was always in tune with my blackness, you know, from the time I was, you know, in the second grade.
Weren't there a lot of other people from your neighborhood who got bused to Bensonhurst?
There was like a contingent, about like five of us.
Five, that's all?
Yeah, from my, you know, when I say the neighborhood, I'm just talking about like a block, like a two-block radius. You know, when you grow up like in a bad neighborhood, there's not a lot of venturing out. So my neighborhood was like two blocks to me. Then the rest of the neighborhood, I didn't go anywhere because anything could happen. My mother wasn't having it.
So how many African-American students would you say there were in the schools that you got
busted? In the schools, okay. I was like the only black kid in my grade a couple of times.
Wow, uh-huh.
I was the only black boy. And then there were like two black girls, three black girls. For like most of my grade school. And the girls had each other. I was kind of like by myself.
So you think that contributed to your being a comedian because you were so alienated?
Yeah, I was alienated. And I had nothing else to do. You know, I always loved comedy. You know, I had nothing to fall back on. I have no real skills. You know, if I picked up a paper right now and, you know, went through the want ads, there's nothing I could get that would pay me more than minimum wage. So I loved comedy, got into it, was a little twisted. You know, my schooling had twisted me somewhat. And it really helped me out. I mean, I would say probably today, most black people, not most black people, but a lot of black people, you don't really experience racism hands-on. You always, like my brothers who didn't get bused to school, like they experience the effects of racism, you know, living in a bad neighborhood, you know, you can't get the cab, you know, bad jobs, all that stuff. But very few people get that, especially in the North, that, hey, nigga, you know, that in your face every day. You know, there's not a lot of guys my age that have been through what I've been through.
How did you get your first comedy break?
How did I get my first comedy break? I was discovered by Eddie Murphy at the comic strip in New York about 8 years ago now. And he saw my act, liked what I was doing, and put me in this HBO special called the Uptown Comedy Express. It was on me, Robert Townsend, Arsenio Hall, Marsha Warfield, and Barry Sobel. And this aired about eight years ago.
Must have been pretty exciting for you because Eddie Murphy was one of the people you really wanted to emulate.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy was an idol of mine. I wouldn't say, I never really wanted to emulate his work per se. Like, I love his work. I just always wanted to do some other thing. I idolized him as a personality, mm-hmm. more so mm-hmm. than anything else. Like, wow, it's a young guy doing it. More so than the actual art part of it. But it's, you know, if I had to pattern myself after anybody, it's more of a Sam Kinison thing.
What qualities of his? That in your face quality?
That in your face shock. Things that are said every day but never said on stage quality. I don't know. I just remember Sam Kinison when I was coming up was like the only guy that sounded new. Everybody else was kind of doing different versions of other guys. Kinison was like totally new. I mean, even Eddie did Pryor. Pryor kind of did Cosby, and you know, Jerry Seinfeld did Robert Klein. Everybody kind of did somebody. And Sam, I don't know anybody that sounds like Sam Kinison.
No, I have a question about your voice. Your voice in your onstage performances, in when you're doing comedy, is much deeper, louder, and rougher than your voice in conversation, which is higher and lighter.
Right.
Almost sweeter, if I could use that word.
Oh, thanks.
And I almost feel like, are you not comfortable with that voice on stage? Do you feel like you need a harder-edged voice to do your comedy?
Well, you know, it's the money's on the line. It's like people are paying $25. They want a performance. They don't want me. They want me to be better than me. I got to look better than me. I got to be taller, louder, funny. I have to be more. I mean, when you're on stage, it's kind of like being a woman, you know? It's like, put on the makeup, do the hair. You know, nobody wants me. They want Chris Rock. I'm just Chris.
so you got to put on a personality on stage.
Well, I got to be bigger than I normally am. I mean, at the same token, I couldn't walk through life acting the way I act on stage.
Well, right, without getting hit a lot, probably.
Right, exactly.
Did being really skinny, do you think, affect who you became and how people thought of you? Or, you know, how you see yourself as a comic?
Totally. Being skinny has affected every aspect of my life. Put it this way. Look at my stand-up. My stand-up, I have twice as many. I always say comedy, stand-up comedy and boxing are pretty much the same. You know, boxing is to sports what stand-up is to entertainment, because it's just a guy out there by himself. And I perform like a skinny boxer. I don't have the ability to knock you out, so I have twice... You take my hour special and anybody else's hour special. I probably have twice as many jokes compact in it. Because I'm so... my size has me so insecure, I'm always working twice as hard. So, yeah, being skinny is... totally affected me and totally weirded me out.
Speaking of boxing,
men are crazy.
Did people fight with you a lot when you were young and take advantage of your size?
Totally.
Did you?
And the only reason they don't do it now is because I'm me.
Right, you're famous.
That's the only reason.
Did you learn to fight?
When you're as small as I am, it doesn't really matter.
Try martial arts or anything?
Martial arts. Some big guy will just grab you and throw you down. What's the point?
Did you try to cripple your opponent with comedy?
I've just, you know, stayed out of environments and situations where fights may occur. No drinking. Like, I don't drink because I can't fight. Wherever it is, alcohol served as a bouncer because people get out of hand. So I can't. Too little to be around guys that get out of hand. So I can't drink. Poor woe is me. I'm sure Woody and Spike think the same.
Oh, you can have them on your show and talk about it. A little self-help.
Yeah. That's why I love Spike. Brooklyn and Skinny.
Chris Rock speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. He hosts the Oscars this Sunday. Coming up, David Edelstein on Diary of a Mad Black Woman. This is Fresh Air. Diary of a Mad Black Woman is a romantic comedy of revenge and redemption about a loyal and loving wife who's replaced by a younger woman after many years of marriage. The film is based on a play by Tyler Perry, who has built a large following in the past decade and who appears in three roles. The film also stars Kimberly Elise and, as her lawyer husband, Steve Harris, who played a nicer lawyer on TV's The Practice. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Gogol's classic story, Diary of a Madman, was about a bureaucrat going nuts, but its 1970 film variation, Diary of a Mad Housewife, starring Carrie Snodgrass, had more to do with a neglected woman discovering her own, you know, personhood. The heroine of Diary of a Mad Black Woman, Helen, played by Kimberly Elise, isn't crazy either. She's just mad as hell at her rich attorney husband, who throws her out of their mansion after 18 years of marriage. But unlike the protagonist of Diary of a Mad Housewife, Helen is on a different kind of journey, a fairy tale journey to forgiveness, to letting go of anger and finding new love, both human and divine. The film is written by Tyler Perry, who co-stars in drag as Helen's grandmother, Medea, and as a couple of male characters, too. It's based on a play of his. Perry has reportedly made millions, performing for huge African-American audiences in theaters all over the country. Diary of a Mad Black Woman demonstrates why he has a following. The film is half inspired and half really, really terrible, but you're never in doubt that this guy knows how to push his audience's buttons. He's a real populist entertainer for the African-American church-going middle class, able to weave campy slapstick through a story of faith, love, and salvation, with drug jokes and anti-drug sermons nestled side by side. In the opening sequence, the pampered kitty cat Helen accompanies Charles, played by Steve Harris, to an Attorney of the Year banquet, where he blows her theatrical kisses from the podium. But the next day, she finds a U-Haul out front with all her clothes in it and a slinky new wardrobe meant for someone else in her closet. In an especially florid, crude, and frankly unbelievable scene, she's literally thrown out of the house, kicking and screaming, while the young mistress in a micro mini dress stands by pouting. It turns out that over the course of their marriage, Charles has forbidden her to stay in touch with her black working class family, to which she now returns, ashamed and, of course, mad. And here's where Diary of a Mad Black Woman swerves from heavy-handed melodrama into screamingly funny drag sitcom territory. Perry's grandma, Medea, is a gun-toting, chainsaw-wielding hurricane bent on justice for all black women. And unlike Helen's mild, elderly, deeply religious mama, played by Cicely Tyson, Medea believes in being a mad black woman.
Peace is always still around me because that keeps me what they call a piece of steel. As long as you got a piece of steel, you're going to have peace. Load your steel. Thank you, Jesus.
You're not reading the right part of it.
Look here. That all sound real good and everything. You're talking about the peace, be still, and the Bible and all that stuff. But you got to be careful. Because I remember this man did me wrong. Honey, I didn't even know how mad I was till I got to his funeral. He had died.
Why were you so mad at him?
Because he hit me. Yes, he did. He hit me. And he is 8 feet under.
6 feet under. That's where they bury folks, 6 feet.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. I thought I was over what the man had done to me till I saw him laying there in that casket. The man was dead, and I got mad all over again. I beat him down 2 more feet. I was mad as hell.
That scene is a howl, but the movie is so schizoid that it's also very misleading. Much of the time is spent on the courtship between Helen and her Prince Charming, Orlando, played by former The Young and the Restless stud, Shamar Moore. This saccharine harlequin romance would make a great camp drag show in Provincetown, Massachusetts, but it's played soap opera straight, although I wasn't sure quite how to take the climax of Orlando's declaration of love. Quote, "I'd go to the grocery store and I'd buy you feminine products. I swear I would." That can't be straight, yet it's said straight, and it's followed by Helen's unambiguously straight tribute to this, quote, beautiful, sensitive, and Christian man, who would not have carnal relations with her that night. "He chose to give me something better," she tells her diary in voiceover. "He gave me intimacy." I don't have any problem with the movie's traditional values, or that a major character who's severely injured comes back to life with the help of the Holy Bible, or that a junkie finds the strength to kick the habit in church. It's the insipidness, the preachiness, the sheer dumbness of the writing and directing, and the way it makes the actors, including the wonderful Kimberly Elise, look brain dead. It's hard to get my mind around how alternately funny and awful this movie is. I guess you could call this review Diary of a Mad Film Critic.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine reports on how arts education is being used to boost student achievement in Texas schools. At FordFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bill Spaceman Lee on the adventures of a baseball vagabond. The former Red Sox player has a new memoir. Also, Downfall, The Last Days of Hitler. We meet the film's star, Bruno Ganz, and director Oliver Hirschbiegel. Join us for the next Fresh Air.